forks, fish slices, butter knives, and sugar tongs. We should both prefer if we could both afford it. And really, we go away as if we'd got them. Then, when we stroll into the squares and great streets and see a house to let, sometimes we look up at it and say, "How would that do if I was made a judge?" And we parcel it out. Such a room for us, such rooms for the girls, and so forth, until we settle to our satisfaction that it would do or it wouldn't do, as the case may be. Sometimes we go at half price to the pit of the theatre, the very smell of which is cheap, in my opinion, at the money, and there we thoroughly enjoy the play, which Sophie believes every word of, and so do I. In walking home, perhaps we buy a little bit of something at a cook shop, or a little lobster at the fishmonger's, and bring it here and make a splendid supper, chatting about what we've seen. Now, you know, Copperfield, if I was Lord Chancellor, we couldn't do this. You would do something, whatever you were, my dear Traddles, thought I. That would be pleasant and amiable. And by the way, I said aloud, I suppose you never draw any skeletons now. Really, replied Traddles, laughing and reddening. I can't wholly deny that I do, my dear Copperfield. For, being in one of the back rows of the King's Bench the other day, with a pen in my hand, the fancy came into my head to try how I had preserved that accomplishment, and I'm afraid there's a skeleton in a wig on the ledge of the desk. After we'd both laughed heartily, Traddles wound up by looking with a smile at the fire and saying in his forgiving way, "Old Creakle. I have a letter from that old rascal here," said I, "for I never was less disposed to forgive him the way he used to batter Traddles than when I saw Traddles so ready to forgive him himself." "From Creakle the schoolmaster?" exclaimed Traddles. "No. Among the persons who are attracted to me in my rising fame and fortune," said I, looking over my letters, "and who discover that they were always much attached to me, is the selfsame Creakle. He's not a schoolmaster now, Traddles, he's retired. He is a Middlesex magistrate." I thought Traddles might be surprised to hear it, but he wasn't so at all. "How do you suppose he comes to be a Middlesex magistrate?" said I. "Oh, dear me," replied Traddles, "it'd be very difficult to answer that question. Perhaps he voted for somebody, or lent money to somebody, or bought something of somebody, or otherwise obliged somebody, or jobbed for somebody, or knew somebody who got the lieutenant of the county to nominate him for the commission." "On the commission he is, at any rate," said I, "and he writes to me here that he will be glad to show me in operation the only true system of prison discipline, the only unchallengeable way of making sincere and lasting converts and penitents, which, you know, is by solitary confinement. What do you say to the system?" inquired Traddles, looking grave. "No, to my accepting the offer and your going with me." "I don't object," said Traddles. "Then I'll write to say so. You remember, to say nothing of our treatment, this same Creakle turning his son out of doors, I suppose, and the life he used to lead his wife and daughter." "Perfectly," said Traddles. "Yet, if you read his letter, you'll find he is the tenderest of men to prisoners convicted of the whole calendar of felonies," said I, "though I can't find that his tenderness extends to any other class of created beings." Traddles shrugged his shoulders and was not at all surprised. I hadn't expected him to be, and wasn't surprised myself, or my observation of similar practical satires would have been but scanty. We arranged the time of our visit, and I wrote accordingly to Mr. Creakle that evening. On the appointed day, I think it was the next day, but no matter, Traddles and I repaired to the prison where Mr. Creakle was powerful. It was an immense and solid building, erected at a vast expense. I couldn't help thinking, as we approached the gate, what an uproar would have been made in the country if any deluded man had proposed to spend one half the money it had cost on the erection of an industrial school for the young or a house of refuge for the deserving old. In an office that might have been on the ground floor of the Tower of Babel, it was so massively constructed, we were presented to our old schoolmaster, who was one of a group composed of two or three of the busier sort of magistrates, and some visitors they had brought. He received me like a man who had formed my mind in bygone years, and had always loved me tenderly. On my introducing Traddles, Mr. Creakle expressed in like manner, but in an inferior degree, that he had always been Traddles' guide, philosopher, and friend. Our venerable instructor was a great deal older, and not improved in appearance. His face was as fiery as ever, his eyes were as small and rather deeper set. The scanty, wet-looking grey hair by which I remembered him was almost gone, and the thick veins in his bald head were none the more agreeable to look at. After some conversation among these gentlemen, from which I might have supposed that there was nothing in the world to be legitimately taken into account but the supreme comfort of prisoners at any expense, and nothing on the wide earth to be done outside prison doors, we began our inspection. It being then just dinner-time, we went first into the great kitchen, where every prisoner's dinner was in course of being set out separately, to be handed to him in his cell, with the regularity and precision of clockwork. I set aside to Traddles that I wondered whether it occurred to anybody that there was a striking contrast between these plentiful repasts of choice quality and the dinners, not to say of paupers, but of soldiers, sailors, labourers, the great bulk of the honest working community, of whom not one man in 500 ever dined half so well. But I learned that the system required high living, and, in short, to dispose of the system once for all, I found that on that head and on all others, the system put an end to all doubts and disposed of all anomalies. Nobody appeared to have the least idea that there was any other system but the system to be considered. As we were going through some of the magnificent passages, I inquired of Mr. Creakle and his friends what were supposed to be the main advantages of this all-governing and universally overriding system. I found them to be the perfect isolation of prisoners, so that no one man in confinement there knew anything about another, and the reduction of prisoners to a wholesome state of mind leading to sincere contrition and repentance. Now, it struck me, when we began to visit individuals in their cells, and to traverse the passages in which those cells were, and to have the manner of the going to chapel and so forth explained to us, that there was a strong probability of the prisoners knowing a good deal about each other, and of their carrying on a pretty complete system of intercourse. This, at the time I write, has been proved, I believe, to be the case. But, as it would have been flat blasphemy against the system to have hinted such a doubt then, I looked out for the penitents as diligently as I could. And here again I had great misgivings. I found as prevalent a fashion in the form of the penitents as I had left outside in the forms of the coats and waistcoats in the windows of the tailors' shops. I found a vast amount of profession, varying very little in character, varying very little, which I thought exceedingly suspicious, even in words. I found a great many foxes disparaging whole vineyards of inaccessible grapes, but I found very few foxes whom I would have trusted within reach of a bunch. Above all, I found that the most professing men were the greatest objects of interest, and that their conceit, their vanity, their want of excitement and their love of deception, which many of them possessed to an almost incredible extent, as their history showed, all prompted to these professions and were all gratified by them. However, I heard so repeatedly in the course of our goings to and fro of a certain number 27, who was the favourite, and who really appeared to be a model prisoner, that I resolved to suspend my judgment until I should see 27. 28, I understood, was also a bright particular star, but it was his misfortune to have his glory a little dimmed by the extraordinary lustre of 27. I heard so much at 27 of his pious admonitions to everybody around him, and of the beautiful letters he constantly wrote to his mother, whom he seemed to consider in a very bad way, that I became quite impatient to see him. I had to restrain my impatience for some time on account of 27 being reserved for a concluding effect. But at last we came to the door of his cell, and Mr. Creakle, looking through a little hole in it, reported to us in a state of the greatest admiration that he was reading a hymn book. There was such a rush of heads immediately to see number 27 reading his hymn book that the little hole was blocked up 6 or 7 heads deep. To remedy this inconvenience, and give us an opportunity of conversing with 27 in all his purity, Mr. Creakle directed the door of the cell to be unlocked, and 27 to be invited out into the passage. This was done. And whom should Traddles and I then behold, to our amazement, in this converted number 27, but Uriah Heep? He knew us directly, and said as he came out with the old writhe, "How do you do, Mr. Copperfield? How do you do, Mr. Traddles?" This recognition caused a general admiration in the party. I rather thought that everyone was struck by his not being proud and taking notice of us. "Well, 27, said Mr. Creakle, mournfully admiring him, "how do you find yourself today?"
"I am very humble, sir," replied Uriah Heep.
"You are always so, 27,
said Mr. Creakle. Here another gentleman asked with extreme anxiety, "Are you quite comfortable?"
"Yes, I thank you, sir," said Uriah Heep, looking in that direction.
"Far more comfortable here than ever I was outside. I see my follies now, sir. That's what makes me comfortable."
Several gentlemen were much affected, and a third questioner, forcing himself to the front, inquired with extreme feeling, "How do you find the beef?"
"Thank you, sir,"
replied Uriah, glancing in the new direction of this voice.
"It was tougher yesterday than I could wish, but it's my duty to bear. I have committed follies, gentlemen," said Uriah, looking round with a meek smile, "and I ought to bear the consequences without repining."
A murmur, partly of gratification at 27's celestial state of mind, and partly of indignation against the contractor who had given him any cause of complaint, a note of which was immediately made by Mr. Creakle, having subsided, 27 stood in the midst of us, as if he felt himself the principal object of merit in a highly meritorious museum, that we, the neophytes, might have an excess of light shining upon us all at once. Orders were given to let out 28. I'd been so much astonished already that I only felt a kind of resigned wonder when Mr. Littimer walked forth reading a good book. 28, said a gentleman in spectacles who had not yet spoken. "You complained last week, my good fellow, of the cocoa. How has it been since?"
"I thank you, sir," said Mr. Littimer. "It has been better made. If I might take the liberty of saying so, sir, I don't think the milk which is boiled with it is quite genuine. But I'm aware, sir, that there is great adulteration of milk in London, and that the article in a pure state is difficult to be obtained."
It appeared to me that the gentleman in spectacles backed his 28 against Mr. Creakle's 27, for each of them took his own man in hand. "What is your state of mind, 28? Said the questioner in spectacles.
"I thank you, sir," returned Mr. Littimer. "I see my follies now, sir. I am a great deal troubled when I think of the sins of my former companions, sir, but I trust they may find forgiveness."
"You're quite happy yourself,"
said the questioner, nodding encouragement.
"I am much obliged to you, sir," returned Mr. Littimer.
"Perfectly so." "Is there anything at all on your mind now?" said the questioner. "If so, mention it, 28.
"Sir," said Mr. Littimer, without looking up, "if my eyes have not deceived me, there is a gentleman present
who was acquainted with me in my former life. It may be profitable to have that gentleman to know, sir, that I attribute my past follies entirely to having lived a thoughtless life, sir, in the service of young men, and to having allowed myself to be led by them into weaknesses which I had not the strength to resist. I hope that gentleman will take warning, sir, and will not be offended at my freedom. It is for his good. I am conscious of my own past follies. I hope he may repent of all the wickedness and sin to which he has been a party. I observed that several gentlemen were shading their eyes, each with one hand, as if they had just come into church. "This does you credit, 28," returned the questioner. "I should have expected it of you. Is there anything else?" "Sir," returned Mr. Littimer, slightly lifting up his eyebrows, but not his eyes, "there was a young woman who fell into dissolute courses that I endeavoured to save, sir, but could not rescue. I beg that gentleman, if he has it in his power, to inform that young woman from me that I forgive her her bad conduct towards myself, and that I call her to repentance, if he will be so good." "I have no doubt, 28, returned the questioner, "that the gentleman you refer to feels very strongly, as we all must, what you have so properly said. We will not detain you."
"I thank you, sir," said Mr. Littimer. "Gentlemen, I wish you a good day, and hoping you and your families will also see your wickedness and amend." With this, number 28 retired, after a glance between him and Uriah, as if they were not altogether unknown to each other through some medium of communication, and a murmur went round the group as his door shut upon him that he was a most respectable man and a beautiful case.
"Now, 27,
said Mr. Creakle, entering on a clear stage with his man,
"is there anything that anyone can do for you? If so, mention it."
"I would humbly ask, sir," returned Uriah with a jerk of his malevolent head, "for leave to write again to mother."
"It shall certainly be granted,"
said Mr. Creakle.
"Thank you, sir. I'm anxious about mother. I'm afraid she ain't safe."
Somebody incautiously asked, "What from?" But there was a scandalized whisper of, "Hush!"
"Immortally safe, sir,"
returned Uriah, writhing in the direction of the voice.
"I should wish mother to be got into my state. I never should have been got into my present state if I hadn't come here. I wish mother had come here. It would be better for everybody if they got took up and was brought here."
This sentiment gave unbounded satisfaction, greater satisfaction, I think, than anything that had passed yet.
"Before I come here,"
said Uriah, stealing a look at us as if he would have blighted the outer world to which we belonged, if he could,
"I was given to follies, but now I'm sensible of my follies. There's a deal of sin outside. There's a deal of sin in mother. There's nothing but sin everywhere, except here."
"You're quite changed?"
said Mr. Creakle.
"Oh, dear, yes, sir,"
cried this hopeful penitent.
"You wouldn't relapse if you were going out?"
asked somebody else.
"Oh, dear, no, sir."
"Well," said Mr. Creakle, "this is very satisfying. You've addressed Mr. Copperfield, 27. Do you wish to say anything further to him?"
"You knew me a long time before I came here and was changed, Mr. Copperfield,"
said Uriah, looking at me, and a more villainous look I never saw even on his visage.
"You knew me when, in spite of my follies, I was humble among them that was proud, and meek among them that was violent. You was violent to me yourself, Mr. Copperfield. Once you struck me a blow in the face, you know.
general commiseration. Several indignant glances directed at me.
But I forgive you, Mr. Copperfield,
said Uriah, making his forgiving nature the subject of a most impious and awful parallel, which I shall not record.
I forgive everybody. It would ill become me to bear malice. I freely forgive you, and I hope you'll curb your passions in future. I hope Mr. W. will repent, and Miss W., and all of that sinful lot. You've been visited with affliction, and I hope it may do you good. But you'd better have come here. Mr. W. had better have come here, and Miss W. too. The best wish I could give you, Mr. Copperfield, and give all of you gentlemen, is that you could be took up and brought here. When I think of my past follies and my present state, I'm sure it would be best for you. I pity all who ain't brought here. He sneaked back into his cell amidst a little chorus of approbation, and both Traddles and I experienced a great relief when he was locked in. It was a characteristic feature in this repentance that I was fain to ask what these two men had done to be there at all. That appeared to be the last thing about which they had anything to say. I addressed myself to one of the two warders, who I suspected from certain latent indications in their faces, knew pretty well what all this stir was worth. "Do you know," said I, as we walked along the passage, "what felony was Number 27's last folly?" The answer was that it was a bank case.
"A fraud on the Bank of England?" I asked.
"Yes, sir. Fraud, forgery and conspiracy, he and some others. He set the others on. It was a deep plot for a large sum. Sentence, transportation for life. 27 was the knowingest bird of the lot and had very nearly kept himself safe, but not quite. The bank was just able to put salt upon his tail, and only just.
Do you know 28's offence?
28, returned my informant, speaking throughout in a low tone and looking over his shoulder as we walked along the passage to guard himself from being overheard in such an unlawful reference to these immaculates by Creakle and the rest. 28, also transportation, got a place and robbed the young master of a matter of £250 in money and valuables the night before they were going abroad. I particularly recollect his case from his being took by a dwarf.
A what?
A little woman. I forgot the name. Not Mocha. That's it. He'd eluded pursuit and was going to America in a flaxen wig and whiskers and such a complete disguise as never you see in all your born days, when the little woman, being in Southampton, met him walking along the street, picked him out with a sharp eye in a moment, rang betwixt his legs to upset him, and held on to him like grim death. "Excellent Miss Mocha!" cried I. "You'd have said so if you'd seen her, standing on a chair in the witness box at his trial, as I did," said my friend. "He cut her face right open and pounded her in the most brutal manner when she took him, but she never loosed her hold till he was locked up. She held so tight to her, in fact, that the officers were obliged to take them both together. She gave her evidence in the gamest way, and was highly complimented by the bench and cheered right home to her lodgings. She said in court that she'd have took him single-handed on account of what she knew concerning him if he'd been Samson. That is my belief she would. It was mine, too, and I highly respected Miss Mocha for it. We had now seen all there was to see. It would have been in vain to represent to such a man as the worshipful Mr. Creakle that 27 and 28 were perfectly consistent and unchanged, that exactly what they were then they'd always been, that the hypocritical knaves were just the subjects to make that sort of profession in such a place, that they knew its market value at least as well as we did, in the immediate service it would do them when they were expatriated. In a word, that it was a rotten, hollow, painfully suggestive piece of business altogether. We left them to their system and themselves and went home wondering. "Perhaps it's a good thing, Traddle," said I, "to have an unsound hobby ridden hard, for it's the sooner ridden to death.
"I hope so," replied Traddles.
Chapter 62. A Light Shines on My Way. The year came round to Christmas time, and I'd been at home above 2 months. I'd seen Agnes frequently. However loud the general voice might be in giving me encouragement, and however fervent the emotions and endeavours to which it roused me, I heard her lightest word of praise as I heard nothing else. At least once a week, and sometimes oftener, I rode over there and passed the evening. I usually rode back at night, for the old unhappy sense was always hovering about me now, most sorrowfully when I left her, and I was glad to be up and out rather than wandering over the past in weary wakefulness or miserable dreams. I wore away the longest part of many wild, sad nights in those rides, reviving as I went the thoughts that had occupied me in my long absence. Or, if I were to say rather that I listened to the echoes of those thoughts, I should better express the truth. They spoke to me from afar off. I put them at a distance, and accepted my inevitable place. When I read to Agnes what I wrote, when I saw her listening face, moved her to smiles or tears, and heard her cordial voice so earnest on the shadowy events of that imaginative world in which I lived, I thought what a fate mine might have been, but only thought so as I thought after I was married to Dora what I could have wished my wife to be. My duty to Agnes, who loved me with a love which, if I disquieted, I wronged most selfishly and poorly, and could never restore, my matured assurance that I, who had worked out my own destiny, and won what I had impetuously set my heart on, had no right to murmur and must bear, comprised what I felt and what I'd learned. But I loved her. And now it even became some consolation to me vaguely to conceive a distant day when I might blamelessly avow it. When all this should be over, when I could say, "Agnes, so it was when I came home, and now I'm old, and I never have loved since." She didn't once show me any change in herself. What she always had been to me, she still was, wholly unaltered. Between my aunt and me, there'd been something in this connection since the night of my return, which I cannot call a restraint or an avoidance of the subject so much as an implied understanding that we thought of it together, but didn't shape our thoughts into words. When, according to our old custom, we sat before the fire at night, we often fell into this train, as naturally and as consciously to each other as if we had unreservedly said so. But we preserved an unbroken silence. I believed that she'd read, or partly read, my thoughts that night, and that she fully comprehended why I gave them no more distinct expression. This Christmas time being come, and Agnes having reposed no new confidence in me, a doubt that had several times arisen in my mind, whether she could have that perception of the true state of my breast, which restrained her with the apprehension of giving me pain, began to oppress me heavily. If that were so, my sacrifice was nothing. My plainest obligation to her unfulfilled, and every poor action I had shrunk from, I was hourly doing. I resolved to set this right beyond all doubt. If such a barrier were between us, to break it down at once with a determined hand. It was, what lasting reason have I to remember it, a cold, harsh winter day. There had been snow some hours before, and it lay not deep, but hard frozen on the ground. Out at sea, beyond my window, the wind blew ruggedly from the north. I'd been thinking of it sweeping over those mountain wastes of snow in Switzerland, then inaccessible to any human foot,
and had been speculating which was the lonelier, those solitary regions or a deserted ocean. "Riding today, Trot?" said my aunt, putting her head in at the door. "Yes," said I, "I'm going over to Canterbury. It's a good day for a ride." "I hope your horse may think so, too," said my aunt. "For the present he's holding down his head in his ears, standing before the door there, as if he thought his stable preferable." My aunt, I may observe, allowed my horse on the forbidden ground, but had not at all relented towards the donkeys. "He'll be fresh enough presently," said I. "The ride will do his master good, at all events," observed my aunt, glancing at the papers on my table. "Ah, child, you pass a good many hours here. I never thought, when I used to read books, what work it was to write them." "It's work enough to read them sometimes," I returned. "As to the writing, it has its own charms, aunt." "Ah, I see," said my aunt. "Ambition, love of approbation, sympathy, and much more, I suppose. Well, go and go with you." "Do you know anything more?" said I, standing composedly before her. She'd patted me on the shoulder and sat down in my chair. "Of that attachment of Agnes's?" She looked up in my face a little while before replying, "I think I do, Trot." "Are you confirmed in your impression?" I inquired. "I think I am, Trot." She looked so steadfastly at me, with a kind of doubt or pity or suspense in her affection, that I summoned the stronger determination to show her a perfectly cheerful face. "And what is more, Trot," said my aunt.
"Yes?"
"I think Agnes is going to be married."
"God bless her," said I cheerfully.
"God bless her," said my aunt, "and her husband too." I echoed it, parted from my aunt, went lightly downstairs, mounted and rode away. There was greater reason than before to do what I had resolved to do. How well I recollect the wintry ride. The frozen particles of ice brushed from the blades of grass by the wind and borne across my face. The hard clatter of the horse's hooves beating a tune upon the ground. The stiff, tilled soil. The snowdrift lightly eddying in the chalk pit as the breeze ruffled it. The smoking team with the wagon of old hay stopping to breathe on the hilltop and shaking their bells musically. The whitened slopes and sweeps of downland lying against the dark sky as if they were drawn on a huge slate. I found Agnes alone. The little girls had gone to their own homes now, and she was alone by the fire reading. She put down her book on seeing me come in, and having welcomed me as usual, took her workbasket and sat in one of the old-fashioned windows. I sat beside her on the window-seat, and we talked of what I was doing and when it would be done, and of the progress I'd made since my last visit. Agnes was very cheerful and laughingly predicted that I should soon become too famous to be talked to on such subjects. "So I make the most of the present time, you see," said Agnes, "and talk to you while I may." As I looked at her beautiful face, observant of her work, she raised her mild, clear eyes and saw that I was looking at her. "You're thoughtful today, Trotwood." "Agnes, shall I tell you what about? I came to tell you." She put aside her work, as she was used to do when we were seriously discussing anything, and gave me her whole attention. "My dear Agnes, do you doubt my being true to you?"
"No," she answered, with a look of astonishment.
"Do you doubt my being what I always have been to you?"
"No," she answered, as before.
"Do you remember that I tried to tell you when I came home what a debt of gratitude I owed you, dearest Agnes, and how fervently I felt towards you?"
"I remember it," she said gently, "very well."
"You have a secret," said I. "Let me share it, Agnes." She cast down her eyes and trembled. I could hardly fail to know, even if I'd not heard, but from other lips than yours, Agnes, which seems strange, that there is someone upon whom you have bestowed the treasure of your love. Do not shut me out of what concerns your happiness so nearly.
If you can trust me as you say you can, and as I know you may, let me be your friend, your brother in this matter of all others. With an appealing, almost a reproachful glance, she rose from the window, and hurrying across the room as if without knowing where, put her hands before her face and burst into such tears as smote me to the heart. And yet they awakened something in me, bringing promise to my heart. Without my knowing why, these tears allied themselves with the quietly sad smile which was so fixed in my remembrance and shook me more with hope than fear or sorrow. Agnes! Sister, dearest! What have I done?
Let me go away, Trotwood. I'm not well. I'm not myself. I'll speak to you by and by, another time. I'll write to you. Don't speak to me now. Don't! I sought to recollect what she'd said when I had spoken to her on that former night, of her affection needing no return. It seemed a very world that I must search through in a moment. Agnes, I cannot bear to see you so, and to think that I have been the cause. My dearest girl, dearer to me than anything in life, if you are unhappy, let me share your unhappiness. If you're in need of help or counsel, let me try to give it to you. If you have indeed a burden on your heart, let me try to lighten it. For whom do I live now, Agnes, if it is not for you?
Oh, spare me, I am not myself another time, was all I could distinguish. Was it a selfish error that was leading me away? Or, having once a clue to hope, was there something opening to me that I had not dared to think of? I must say more. I cannot let you leave me so. For heaven's sake, Agnes, let us not mistake each other. After all these years and all that has come and gone with them, I must speak plainly. If you have any lingering thought that I could envy the happiness you will confer, that I couldn't resign you to a dearer protector of your own choosing, that I could not from my removed place be a contented witness of your joy, dismiss it, for I don't deserve it. I've not suffered quite in vain. You've not taught me quite in vain. There is no alloy of self in what I feel for you.
This ends side one of cassette 27. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
In a little time, she turned her pale face towards me and said in a low voice, broken here and there but very clear, "I owe it to your pure friendship for me, Trotwood, which indeed I do not doubt, to tell you you are mistaken. I can do no more. If I have sometimes in the course of years wanted help and counsel, they have come to me. If I have sometimes been unhappy, the feeling has passed away. If I have ever had a burden on my heart, it has been lightened for me. If I have any secret, it is no new one, and is not what you suppose. I cannot reveal it or divide it. It has long been mine and must remain mine. Agnes, stay a moment." She was going away, but I detained her. I clasped my arm about her waist. "In the course of years, it is not a new one. New thoughts and hopes were whirling through my mind, and all the colours of my life were changing. Dearest Agnes, whom I so respect and honour, whom I so devotedly love, when I came here today, I thought that nothing could have wrested this confession from me. I thought I could have kept it in my bosom all our lives till we were old. But, Agnes, if I have indeed any newborn hope that I may ever call you something more than sister, widely different from sister,
Her tears fell fast, but they were not like those she had lately shed, and I saw my hope brighten in them. Agnes, ever my guide and best support, if you had been more mindful of yourself and less of me when we grew up here together, I think my heedless fancy never would have wandered from you. But you were so much better than I, so necessary to me in every boyish hope and disappointment, that to have you to confide in and rely upon in everything became a second nature, supplanting for the time the first and greater one of loving you as I do. Still weeping, but not sadly, joyfully, and clasped in my arms as she had never been, as I had thought she never was to be. When I loved Dora, fondly, Agnes, as you know. Yes, she cried earnestly, I'm glad to know it. When I loved her, even then my love would have been incomplete without your sympathy. I had it, and it was perfected. And when I lost her, Agnes, what should I have been without you still? Closer in my arms, nearer to my heart, her trembling hand upon my shoulder, her sweet eyes shining through her tears on mine. I went away, dear Agnes, loving you. I stayed away, loving you. I returned home, loving you. And now I tried to tell her of the struggle I'd had, and the conclusion I'd come to. I tried to lay my mind before her truly and entirely. I tried to show her how I had hoped I'd come into the better knowledge of myself and of her, how I had resigned myself to what that better knowledge brought, and how I had come there even that day in my fidelity to this. If she did so love me, I said, that she could take me for her husband, she could do so on no deserving of mine, except upon the truth of my love for her, and the trouble in which it had ripened to be what it was, and hence it was that I revealed it. And, oh, Agnes, even out of thy true eyes, in that same time, the spirit of my child wife looked upon me, saying it was well, and winning me through thee to tenderest recollections of the blossom that had withered in its bloom. I am so blessed, Trotwood. My heart is so overcharged. But there is one thing I must say.
Dearest, what?
She laid her gentle hands upon my shoulders and looked calmly in my face. Do you know yet what it is?
I'm afraid to speculate on what it is.
Tell me, my dear.
I have loved you all my life.
Oh, we were happy. We were happy. Our tears were not for the trials, curse so much the greater, through which we had come to be thus, but for the rapture of being thus. Never to be divided more. We walked that winter evening in the fields together, and the blessed calm within us seemed to be partaken by the frosty air. The early stars began to shine while we were lingering on, and looking up to them, we thanked our God for having guided us to this tranquillity. We stood together in the same old-fashioned window at night when the moon was shining, Agnes, with her quiet eyes raised up to it, I following her glance. Long miles of road then opened out before my mind, and toiling on, I saw a ragged, way-worn boy, forsaken and neglected, who should come to call even the heart now beating against mine
his own. It was nearly dinner time next day when we appeared before my aunt. She was up in my study, Peggotty said, which it was her pride to keep in readiness and order for me. We found her, in her spectacles, sitting by the fire. "Goodness me," said my aunt, peering through the dusk. "Who's this you're bringing home?" "Agnes," said I. As we'd arranged to say nothing at first, my aunt was not a little discomforted. She darted a hopeful glance at me when I said Agnes, but seeing that I looked as usual, she took off her spectacles in despair and rubbed her nose with them. She greeted Agnes heartily, nevertheless, and we were soon in the lighted parlour downstairs at dinner. My aunt put on her spectacles twice or thrice to take another look at me, but as often took them off again, disappointed, and rubbed her nose with them. Much to the discomfiture of Mr. Dick, who knew this to be a bad symptom. "By the by, aunt," said I after dinner, "I've been speaking to Agnes about what you told me." "Then, Trot," said my aunt, turning scarlet, "you did wrong and broke your promise." "You're not angry, aunt, I trust." "I'm sure you won't be when you learn that Agnes is not unhappy in any attachment." "Stuff and nonsense," said my aunt. As my aunt appeared to be annoyed, I thought the best way was to cut her annoyance short. I took Agnes in my arm to the back of her chair, and we both leant over her. My aunt, with one clap of her hands and one look through her spectacles, immediately went into hysterics, for the first and only time in all my knowledge of her. The hysterics called up Peggotty. The moment my aunt was restored, she flew at Peggotty, and calling her a silly old creature, hugged her with all her might. After that, she hugged Mr. Dick, who was highly honoured but a good deal surprised, and after that told them why. Then we were all happy together. I couldn't discover whether my aunt, in her last short conversation with me, had fallen on a pious fraud, or had really mistaken the state of my mind. It was quite enough, she said, that she had told me Agnes was going to be married, and that I now knew better than anyone how true it was. We were married within a fortnight. Traddles and Sophie, and Dr. and Mrs. Strong, were the only guests at our quiet wedding. We left them full of joy, and drove away together. Clasped in my embrace, I held the source of every worthy aspiration I had ever had. The centre of myself, the circle of my life, my own, my wife, my love of whom was founded on a rock. "Dearest husband," said Agnes, "now that I may call you by that name, I have one thing more to tell you. Let me hear it, love. It grows out of the night when Dora died. She sent you for me."
"She did."
"She told me that she left me something. Can you think what it was?" I believed I could. I drew the wife who had so long loved me closer to my side. She told me that she had made a last request to me and left me a last charge. And it was that only I would occupy this vacant place. And Agnes laid her head upon my breast and wept. And I wept with her, though we were so happy. Chapter 63, A Visitor. What I have purposed to record is nearly finished, but there is yet an incident conspicuous in my memory on which it often rests with delight, and without which one thread in the web I've spun would have a ravelled end. I had advanced in fame and fortune,
My domestic joy was perfect. I'd been married 10 happy years. Agnes and I were sitting by the fire in our house in London one night in spring, and three of our children were playing in the room when I was told that a stranger wished to see me. He'd been asked if he came on business, and had answered no. He'd come for the pleasure of seeing me, and had come a long way. He was an old man, my servant said, and looked like a farmer. As this sounded mysterious to the children, and moreover was like the beginning of a favourite story Agnes used to tell them, introductory to the arrival of a wicked old fairy in a cloak who hated everybody, it produced some commotion. One of our boys laid his head in his mother's lap to be out of harm's way, and little Agnes, our eldest child, left her doll in a chair to represent her, and thrust out her little heap of golden curls from between the window curtains to see what happened next. "Let him come in here," said I. There soon appeared, pausing in the dark doorway as he entered, a hale, grey-haired old man. Little Agnes, attracted by his looks, had run to bring him in, and I had not yet clearly seen his face, when my wife, starting up, cried out to me in a pleased and agitated voice that it was Mr. Peggotty. It was Mr. Peggotty. An old man now, but in a ruddy, hearty, strong old age. Well, our first emotion was over, and he sat before the fire with the children on his knees, and the blaze shining on his face, he looked to me as vigorous and robust, withal as handsome an old man as ever I'd seen. "Master Davy," said he, and the old name in the old tone fell so naturally on my ear. "Master Davy, 'tis a joyful hour as I see you once more along with your own true wife." "A joyful hour indeed, old friend," cried I. "And these here pretty ones," said Mr. Peggotty, "to look at these here flowers. Why, Master Davy, you was but the height of the littlest of these when I first see you, when Emily weren't no bigger, and our poor lad was but a lad." "Time has changed me more than it's changed you since then," said I. "But let these dear rogues go to bed, and as no house in England but this must hold you, tell me where to send for your luggage. Is the old black bag among it that went so far, I wonder? And then, over a glass of Yarmouth grog, we'll have the tidings of 10 years. "Are you alone?" asked Agnes. "Yes, ma'am," he said, kissing her hand. "Quite alone." We sat in between us, not knowing how to give him welcome enough. And as I began to listen to his old, familiar voice, I could have fancied he was still pursuing his long journey in search of his darling niece. "It's a mort of water," said Mr. Peggotty, "fur to come across, and only stay a matter of 4 weeks. But water, especially when 'tis salt, comes natural to me, and friends is dear, and I am here. Which is verse," said Mr. Peggotty, surprised to find it out, though I hadn't such intentions. "Are you going back those many thousand miles so soon?" asked Agnes. "Yes, ma'am," he returned. "I give the promise to Emily afore I come away. You see, I don't grow younger as the years comes round, and if I hadn't sailed as 'twas, most like I shouldn't never have done't. And it's allus been on my mind as I must come and see Master Davy and your own sweet blooming self in your wedded happiness afore I got to be too old." He looked at us as if he could never feast his eyes on us sufficiently. Agnes laughingly put back some scattered locks of his grey hair that he might see us better. "And now tell us," said I, "everything relating to your fortunes." "Our fortunes, Master Davy," he rejoined, "is soon told. We haven't fared no house but fared to thrive. We've allus thrived. We've worked as we ought to, and maybe we lived a little hard at first or so, but we've allus thrived. What with sheep farming, and what with stock farming, and what with one thing and what with t'other, we are as well-to-do as well could be. There's been a kind of blessing fell upon us," said Mr. Peggotty, reverentially inclining his head, "and we've done nought but prosper. That is, in the long run. If not yesterday, why then today? If not today, why then tomorrow?"
"And Emily?" said Agnes and I both together. "Emily," said he, "after you left her, ma'am, and I never heard her saying of her prayers at night t'other side the canvas screen when we was settling in the bush, but I heard your name. And after she and me lost sight of Master Davy that there shining sundown, was that low at first, that if she'd have knowed then what Master Davy kept from us so kind and thoughtful, 'tis my opinion she'd have drooped away. But there was some poor folks aboard as had illness among them, and she took care of them. And there was the children in our company, and she took care of them. And so she got to be busy and to be doing good, and that helped her."
"When did she first hear of it?" I asked.
"I kept it from her after I heard on," said Mr. Peggotty, "going on nigh a year. We was living then in a solitary place, but among the beautifulest trees, and with the roses a-covering our being to the roof. There come along one day, when I was out a-working on the land, a traveller from our own Norfolk or Suffolk in England, I don't rightly mind which, and of course we took him in and give him to eat and drink and made him welcome. We all do that, all the colony over. He'd got an old newspaper with him, and some other account in print of the storm. That's how she knowed it. When I come home at night, I found she knowed it."
He dropped his voice as he said these words, and the gravity I so well remembered overspread his face.
"Did it change her much?" we asked. "Aye, for a good long time," he said, shaking his head, "if not to this present hour. But I think the solitude done her good. And she had a deal to mind in the way of poultry and the like, and minded of it, and come through. I wonder," he said thoughtfully, "if you could see my Emily now, Master Davy, whether you'd know her." "Is she so altered?" I inquired. "I don't know. I see her every day and don't know. But odd times I have thought so." "A slight figure," said Mr. Peggotty, looking at the fire. "Kind of warm. Soft, sorrowful, blue eyes. A delicate face. A pretty head, leaning a little down. A quiet voice and way. Timid, almost. That's Emily."
We silently observed him as he sat still looking at the fire.
"Some things," he said, "as her affection was ill bestowed. Some as her marriage was broke off by death. No one knows how 'tis. She might have married well a more at times, but Uncle," she says to me, "that's gone forever. Cheerful along with me. Retired when others is by. Fond of going any distance for to teach a child, or for to tend a sick person, or for to do some kindness towards a young girl's wedding, and she's done a many, but there's never seen one. Fondly loving of her uncle, patient, liked for young and old, sought out by all that has any trouble. That's Emily."
He drew his hand across his face, and with a half-suppressed sigh looked up from the fire.
"Is Martha with you yet?" I asked. "Martha," he replied, "got married, Master Davy, in the second year. A young man, a farm labourer, has come by us on his way to market with his master's drays. A journey of over 500 miles there and back. Made offers for to take her for his wife. Wives is very scarce there. And then to set up for their two selves in the bush. She spoke to me for to tell him her true story. I did. They was married. And they live 400 miles away from any voices but their own and the singing birds."
"Mrs. Gummidge," I suggested. It was a pleasant key to touch, for Mr. Peggotty suddenly burst into a roar of laughter and rubbed his hands up and down his legs as he'd been accustomed to do when he enjoyed himself in the long shipwrecked boat.
"Would you believe it," he said, "why, someone even made offers for to marry her. If a ship's cook that was turning set to Master Davy didn't make offers for to marry Mrs. Gummidge, I'm gormed, and I can't say no fairer than that."
I never saw Agnes laugh so. This sudden ecstasy on the part of Mr. Peggotty was so delightful to her that she couldn't leave off laughing, and the more she laughed, the more she made me laugh, and the greater Mr. Peggotty's ecstasy became, and the more he rubbed his legs. And what did Mrs. Gummidge say? I asked, when I was grave enough.
If you believe me, returned Mr. Peggotty, Mrs. Gummidge, instead of saying thank you, I'm much obliged to you, I ain't a-going for it to change my condition at my time of life, up with a bucket as was standing by, and laid it over that there ship's cook's head till he sung out for help.